I'm your host, Whit Schiller, and I'm ready to share this fourth episode of the Improv Comedy Connection with you. I really appreciate the support that you guys have given to the podcast this early on, and I know a ton has to do with the great guests that I've been able to share some time with. And today's no exception. I get to interview Morgan Phillips today. He's an improviser and teacher out of New York City with the Upright Citizens Brigade there. And I got a bit of a sense of Morgan's point of view and insights on improv from some snippets of conversation between him and Curtis Rutherford on Curtis's excellent podcast, Improv Beat by Beat. If you haven't heard it yet, you'll want to check that out for sure. Anyway, you'll hear a little bit about one of those insights on this episode and a bunch more too. So let's get right into the Morgan Phillips episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. All right, Morgan. Well, I'm really excited to talk with you today. I know that you have been improvising for a long time.
Fact.
Coming up on 25 years, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But I'd like to get to know a little bit more about your improv story. Could you tell us a little bit about how you started? I think you started in college, right?
I did start in college, yeah. I'm not even sure if I knew of the existence of improv before college, but when I got to college, there was an amazing group on campus at Swarthmore College called Vertigogo, and I went to the first show of my freshman year, and was blown away and auditioned and did not get in.
Okay.
And then didn't audition sophomore year because I didn't want to be that guy who always auditions for things and doesn't get it. I didn't want to get rejected, basically. And then auditioned again junior year and got in. And that'll be 25 years ago this fall.
And what type of improv group was that? Do they do a variety of types of improv or forms?
It was actually a short form group, did a bunch of short form games. And I did short form for the first 10 years or so of my improv career, and then gradually transitioned into doing long form improv, which is what I do pretty exclusively today.
Yeah. So you started with a professional troupe after college?
Yeah. When I moved to New York, I started taking classes with a group called Chicago City Limits, which is actually a New York group, confusingly enough. And I took classes there and eventually got in the touring company there and then the main stage company.
And what else were you doing around this time?
Most of the things that people do when they move to New York out of college.
Yeah.
Sleeping on couches, temp jobs, becoming an adult. A lot of form of experiences, but working full-time. I also actually, while doing the improv, was in a professional a cappella group as well. So originally I was splitting my time between a cappella and improv, both things that I found in college and then didn't have the sense to stop doing after college.
And you'd never done any of the singing in high school or prior to that?
I did do singing in college, in high school. I was in the choir and I did school plays and that sort of, but a cappella only a little bit before getting to college and then out of college as well.
And that was a touring group as well?
It was, yeah. It's a group that still exists today. I sort of retired from a cappella about 10 years ago now, I guess, but the group has continued. They're called Duende, Duwende, if there are any a cappella fans out there.
Musical improv has been also part of your story from early on as well.
It has, yeah. Actually, at Chicago City Limits, the short form group that I was part of, we would improvise a 20-minute musical as part of our short form set based off the day of an audience member. We'd interview an audience member and do a short musical about it. And through people I met at Chicago City Limits, I started doing musical improv at a theater in New York called Magnet Theater. Eventually was in a weekly show there called The Made Up Musical. And I did that for 5 years. And then was also later in a musical improv group at UCB, which is pretty much my home theater now, the Upright Citizens Brigade. The team there was called Diamond Lion, a weekly and then monthly show at UCB.
So when you're doing a 20-minute musical on somebody in kind of a day of the life style, you obviously have a lot to work with, a lot of specifics. Were you directing that towards try to replay that person's story, or were you using it just as inspiration to come up with some other type of storyline, or was it kind of repeating what they had said in a narrative musical format?
For that show, Chicago City Limits, it was pretty much reenacting kind of beat by beat the story they told with room for exploration and finding some surprising things. But it was mostly for the audience, the the thrill of seeing something they just heard described kind of translated into musical theater. Most of the musical improv I've done since then has been a little bit more loosely inspired by whatever the audience suggestion was. So creating the narrative on the spot.
So what types of suggestions are you typically getting? Just a word or a quick idea or a concept or two? Or are you going off of a monologue?
I think at the Magnet Theater, it's been a while since I've done that show, but I believe we were doing audience interviews for that one as well, but then loosely inspiring our musical based off that. For the UCB group, we would get a suggestion of one word most of the time and just go from there. The musical improv at UCB, I wouldn't even call it narrative. Sometimes we'd do a show where it was basically a standard long form montage of scenes, but they just happen to be scenes with songs at the ends of them. Okay. We occasionally also would do a long form form called the mono scene. So it would have a little bit more of a narrative feel, but still, because it was a UCB, Upright Citizens Brigade style long form show, it was mostly about just sort of exploring stuff and finding new comedic games and playing those and singing songs that sort of played those games as well.
So let's go back to when you're at the Chicago City Limits Theater. What gets you to start moving and looking towards other places to improvise and other styles to improvise?
So this was in the late 90s and early 2000s, this was happening. And long form had really just recently come to New York City. The Upright Citizens Brigade moved to New York at approximately the same time as I did in the fall of 1996. And a lot of the people who I most enjoyed working with at Chicago City Limits were simultaneously taking classes and performing at Upright Citizens Brigade, which was this fairly new theater. I don't believe they even had their own theater until around 1999 or so. So it wasn't even an option. I could have taken classes with them earlier, but they didn't have their own theater for a while. Chicago City Limits had its own theater, which seemed very impressive to me at the time. It's even more impressive to me now, knowing how much it takes to keep a theater running. But so all of my, a lot of the people I really respected were doing things at this place, Upright Citizens Brigade, in addition to Chicago City Limits. So I sort of followed them and started studying at UCB in 2003.
In terms of was it the instruction? Was it the style? Was it the other people who you were finding that were congregating at this early stage of the UCB that were drawing you more that way?
I think it was a lot of factors, but I looking back on my short form career, I realized at some point that the game that I enjoyed the most that we would play at Chicago City Limits was a game we called Scene from One Word, which was basically a long form scene where we'd get one word from the audience and then fully improvise a scene inspired by it. So the part of short form that I liked the most was basically the basic component of most long form shows. So once I found out that, oh, there's this improv where that's pretty much all you do, I gravitated towards that.
So with the Scene from One Word, how long would those scenes typically go?
That would just be part of a longer short form set. And I think it was probably 4 minutes or so.
Yeah, kind of a typical scene game length.
Yeah, but without anything put on top of it like you might have in a typical short form game. It's just, we basically just did a scene.
No typical edits or
things like that.
No ringing a bell, changing the word, or having certain walk-ons happen at certain times or anything like that.
So do you find that there's a difference in terms of the audiences that you're seeing in the two contexts?
There's a big difference between the audiences we used to typically get. The Chicago City Limits show was, I think the tickets were $20, which was not expensive for New York, but fairly expensive for a comedy show, especially considering there are a lot of really affordable comedy shows in New York City. And there was also a 2-drink minimum at the club we were performing at. So that audience tended to be tourists and people coming in from sort of for a night on the town. Whereas most of the audiences at Upright Citizens Brigade, it skews a little bit younger. And because most of the tickets are $7, it's sort of people taking a chance or students looking for an affordable night out. It's also a lot of improv students from UCB itself. So it's a very friendly crowd at UCB most of the time. Whereas the crowds for the short form shows were generally friendly, but there also were more, say, groups of bachelorettes or coworkers out for a night on the town, maybe getting a little tipsy and having fun with disrupting the show. So it's a politer audience now, I would say.
Which is the short form audience?
Actually, the long form, the kids, they're so polite.
How do you think that impacts the improv that's actually done on stage?
Well, actually, there is one kind of problem. I enjoy it, but it could be seen as a problem with doing a show where you have a lot of students in the audience. It is a very improv savvy audience most of the time at Upright Citizens Brigade, which makes for a really fun show, and they sort of see the subtle improv moves you do. But that's the crowd during the week. But then if you do a show on the weekend where it's a little bit more tourists and people coming to see a big show, they sometimes won't laugh at things that sort of improv insiders will laugh at. So if you if you just do shows in front of sort of an insider improv crowd, you can get trained to think that they're going to laugh at things that real people or regular people won't necessarily find funny. Like a brilliant improv move from an improviser standpoint, it might be extraordinarily funny, or it might just be other improvisers knowing, oh, that was a really clever move in the context to make.
It seems like there's sometimes someone in the audience who just has that, I don't know, the laughter is almost commentary, like you said, just appreciating a good move or something like that, where somebody off the street maybe kind of, why was that so funny?
And I personally have no problem with whatever reason someone wants to laugh at something, as long as it's not like a creepy reason to laugh at it. but if your goal is to be somebody who can do a show in front of anybody, it's just something to kind of keep in mind that certain audiences will be a little easier than others.
So one of the things that I remember, and I attribute this to you, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe it's not original to you.
I doubt it is. I've stolen most of my ideas.
It's like a lot of things, I suppose.
Many great teachers.
But I won't articulate it as well as I think you did at the time, but you've taken a lot of different classes and courses, and you've been doing this for over a couple decades. But I think you said something to the effect, which resonated with me, that after maybe about 10 years or so, how much you can progress as an improviser is going to be limited or driven by how much you're progressing personally.
I do believe that. And that might be original to me. I'm sure other people have had the same thought, but that is really based on both my own life and also seeing students who've been doing it for a while. There's so many things to work on in your first few years of improv. You constantly have things to work on. And still, even to this day, I'm working on just basic improv skills. I'll feel like I get good at one and maybe a different one will slip a little bit. So it's constantly adjusting that way. But for me personally, issues like wanting people to approve of me and being afraid to make mistakes, things that are true on some level in my real life, they stop me and I've seen others stopped in similar ways from being the improviser I could be or being the improviser they could be.
I think there's an element of, if you decide that improv is an art form where you're going to be vulnerable and disclosing and authentic, then there is this line in between who you are and the characters that you're portraying. And it's really hard to completely divorce the two. I don't think you can. So if you have those personal failings or flaws or limitations, it is something I think to work on to be able to improve your improv and connect with those that you're working on stage. Is that something that you find that others are open to or resistant to, or do they just find different defense mechanisms to overcome or mask what some of those personal, I'll just call them limitations, might be?
Sure, absolutely. All of the above. Different people react different ways. Like you said, vulnerability can be a really amazing component of improv, and it can really push your improv to new levels. And there is that idea that if you really want to be present on stage, it has to be you on some level that's present. It can't all be sort of a mask of the character. There has to be some of you coming through. That being said, there are some improvisers who are just so funny that they don't need to access that. They can get away with being a little more superficial and not actually risking their egos or getting truly vulnerable. And definitely for some improvisers, if that works for them, that's what they're comfortable with, then I would never push someone who didn't want to be pushed in that way. But for me, I know that I notice at a certain point in my improv development, things like being afraid of someone I respect having a low opinion of me would hold me back from making moves in a show. And that's a thing that can hold you back in life too. So as I've grown as a person, I think it's helped my improv. It's mostly been in that direction. I don't know that improv has been a tool for me to break out of my shell or to become a better person in any way. I think it does go hand in hand. I think at a certain point, I saw myself doing the same unfortunate things in improv over and over again, as far as maybe holding back with moves or worrying too much about whether I'd done well in a show. And the only way that I could break through that at all is to work on it in my real life.
When you were first recognizing some of that, was that something that you were conscious of while on stage? Was that reflections after a show that led you to that conclusion?
I think it was both. And I think part of the problem with those problems I was having, and continue to have on different levels today, is that you don't want to be thinking about those sorts of things during a show. You don't want to go to the back line thinking about the mistake you just made, or how you wish you'd done something different, when you could be paying attention to what's going on the stage and potentially supporting the other improvisers. I've had shows where I've been at a high level of proficiency performing with people I really respect, where I've been on the back line thinking, oh, everybody here is better than me. I'm not going to say anything for a little while because I'm going to mess up the show. Which, I mean, there's so many other more constructive things I could have been thinking about.
Were you getting any feedback from others that would try to draw that out if it was something where you were on the back line too much or too long, that people were saying, hey, you know, get out
there? I think for a long time in my improv career, when I would make a big, bold move, people would respond well, but also with a degree of surprise.
That you were surprised?
That they were surprised. That I was, okay. Oh, wow, Morgan, that was amazing what you just did. Like, I'd love to see more of that. And at the time, it wouldn't feel like a particularly bold move to me. And it would feel like, well, I can do that sort of thing anytime. Why is that so surprising to people? And I think it didn't happen as much as it should, partially because of personal blocks I had, I guess.
So when we get back to the training that you've had, it's been in a variety of locations. And I think you've tried to be very intentional about finding as many voices or perspectives, at least that are accessible to you, to inform your skill set and your improv. How has that been helpful to you to get a variety of perspectives?
I used to collect teachers and coaches, is how I would think of it. I'd have literally as many different teachers and coaches as I could, partially because at a certain point, I realized that one teacher could say something that was pretty much the same thing another teacher had said, but the way the new teacher said it, it suddenly made sense to me. And I'll see that happen now that I'm a teacher at UCB. I'll see that happen with students as well, where I'll say something they've probably been told by three or four other teachers, and the way I say it will make sense. And also the opposite. Sometimes I'll say something that seems very clear to me, and I can tell it's not getting through. And I know that at some point they'll hear that same note in a different way, and it'll sort of suddenly their eyes will open. And it's still happening to me today. There's certain teachers where I know that if I take a workshop with them, or I listen to them critiquing someone else, they'll just drop a little pearl of wisdom. And again, I've been doing improv for, it'll be 25 years this fall. One of the things I like about it is you can still make new discoveries. And some of that is just a different perspective on something that you've already encountered a million times.
Is one of those new discoveries something that is fresh, that you remember?
Honestly, my memory is so shoddy that I think it is in the moment, but I'm probably not only hearing things in a new way, but I'm probably hearing things that I've forgot, and they just seem fresh because it's been a while since I've thought of something in that way. I think a lot of the time it is just the slight wording changes that suddenly make something, or a different metaphor that someone uses that makes it clear. But also there's so many things that you could think about in improv, so many different tiny little tactics you can use, or ways of thinking about things, or strategies, or beyond just listening, ways you could listen to someone else, that I think that there's still novel ways to do it, even after you've been doing it a really long time.
From an outsider's point of view, and knowing the way the curriculum is laid out, it does seem like there is a very strong philosophy and theory that is at least underlying the curriculum. Do you find that you are looking for things within that band, or are you seeking things outside? Does that get in the way of playing with others in the UCB?
Yeah, I've done a lot of different types of improv over the years. I've mostly studied at UCB since 2003. But I've done a lot of shows at other theaters like Magnet Theater and the People's Improv Theater, a lot of independent venues, and played with a bunch of different types of improvisers. And I've done narrative shows and shows where there were things we'd focus on that were not sort of UCB style things. I do feel very comfortable teaching at UCB and performing mostly there because for me, that's the way I want to do improv, the UCB way. And the way I think of it is there's a real premium put on getting on the same page with your scene partner or the other people on the team about what is specifically funny in that given scene and making more of that specific funny thing happen. So it's really, I think of it as an emphasis rather than like a style or school of improv, although I guess it's both. The style and school of improv for me of UCB is, can we get on the same page? Can we have a mutual understanding of what's funny in this moment?
And how much do you think that's like a communication style or just an understanding that this is how we're going to approach it that leads to that result or what that comfort level is that you have?
Almost all of it.
Yeah.
A lot of what I do as a teacher is help people develop the strategies to get on the same page about what's funny. I mean, there's a lot of other things that go into it as far as the performance of it and just repeating the types of things that they'll likely do in shows as far as the structures and basic things like yes anding and sort of improv 101 stuff. But beyond improv 101, a lot of what I teach at UCB is how can you best communicate with someone else what you're thinking and figure out what they're thinking with the goal of getting on the same page about what that game of the scene or main funny thing of the scene is.
I don't know if UCB was the first to use the phrase game, but I wonder how much of it is really driven by things like framing, where you do have that moment on stage where somebody is, I guess, recognizing that this is what we're going to play with in the scene, and therefore that other person is on the same page, is moving towards that same thing, building on the same foundation.
Absolutely. Framing is very important for playing games. Sometimes you can think that you have the same idea of what the game of the scene is, and you'll realize later on in the show, oh, we were thinking of that in totally different ways. In a Herald, for instance, you'll sometimes see people have a really successful first scene. And in a UCB style Herald, we are looking to find and play a game in that first scene. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can finish that scene and it feels like we were on the same page about what the game was. We were successfully playing it together. And then we'll go to a second beat where we're supposed to return to that game. And one person will initiate that scene. It'll be instantly clear to the other person, oh, we were thinking of the funny thing in totally different ways because I have no idea what my scene partner is doing right now. And that can be from a lack of framing the game in that first beat. So you can, like so much of improv, you can think something that's in your head is clear to the other person and clear to the audience. But unless you communicate it to the other person and hopefully to the audience as well, directly and clearly, there's a strong chance that your brain is seeing something that nobody else is seeing, or maybe not everybody else is seeing.
And what are some of the communication tools that you use beyond framing? Or maybe it's worth you sharing a bit or two about what framing means to you.
When I use the term framing in a class, I use it as a blanket term for anything you can say out loud that communicates what you think is funny about the scene. And it could be literally labeling what you think the funny thing in the scene is, or drawing attention to something that feels unusual or funny or strange with the goal of maybe figuring out what's funny about it. So basically anything you would say out loud that communicates to your scene partner, hey, I think we might have something here, or hey, I think this is the game of the scene, I would label that as framing.
And then in terms of other things to keep you on the same page, what other communication tools do you, I guess, teach or try to encourage?
There's so many components that go into it. Listening, obviously, is hugely important, both because someone might communicate something subtly about the who, what, where, the base reality of the scene. And if you can be easy to miss, so you want to make sure you're on the same page about that. But also listening, because they may say something, your scene partner may say something that to you means something that they didn't even realize it could mean. And then if you say that out loud, kind of explain the thing that you just heard and how you perceived it, then that's true about the scene now. Anything you say out loud is then true about the scene. And if you don't say it out loud, it might not be true about the scene for everybody. So right. Listening, framing, and then within listening and framing, there's a million different parts of each of those. So moment to moment, I mean, every scene is slightly different. That's what makes it so challenging and still fun for me 25 years in, is it's sort of like comparable to a sport where you might know the general rules of the sport, but the games themselves, the moment by moment, is totally different each time.
So when you are working with other improvisers in a different school or a different approach, do you find that you are trying to communicate in the same kind of way as a UCB style or a training? Do you find that ends up being awkward sometimes, or there's misses?
Sometimes, one of the great things about the UCB manual coming out, and I guess it's been maybe a decade since it came out. I don't remember exactly when it came out. But one of the helpful things from a teaching perspective is they kind of tried to define some of the improv terms that we use at UCB. So at least within UCB, we now have a shared understanding of certain terms, assuming people have read the manual. So when I teach people or work with people who have not read the UCB manual or not students at UCB, sometimes I will use a term that means one thing to me and means something totally different for them. So I try to stay aware of that. But also, I try to get a good sense of what the group's goals are, because they might not have the goal of getting on the exact same page about one main game in a scene. There's plenty of great improv out there where they're open to any sort of discoveries, maybe five or six different funny things in a scene. Or maybe they're going for a more narrative approach where it's got a humorous component, but we're also taking time to dive into the psychology of the characters. So I, as a teacher, try to get a sense of what the students or what the group I'm working with, what their goals are. I'm always happy to sort of spread the gospel of a game of the scene, but I don't in any way think that is the only way to do improv or necessarily even the best way to do improv. It's the way that I enjoy doing it the most. And I have done a bunch of different types of improv, so I know what I'm talking about. I'm going to confess, I'm secretly proselytizing for Game of the Scene as being the best way to do improv. All joking aside, the funniest moments in improv that I've seen have come as a result of improvisers being on the same page about exactly what was funny and everybody pushing in the same direction to make that more of that funny thing happen. And that can happen in shows where we don't have a specific focus on Game of the Scene. But if we have that language of the Game of the Scene, I think we're slightly more likely to be trying to do that as opposed to potentially working at cross purposes. If I'm working on my funny thing and you're working on your funny thing, those can both be really funny things. But what if we were collaborating to make each other's things happen?
So can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure.
Let me tell you what I'm, I guess, thinking with that. Earlier, we talked about how there's some improv savvy audiences and then more kind of public, or to use your term, tourists, where the sensibilities are maybe a little bit different about what's funny. But it strikes me that when you're saying that you're talking about something that's like the funniest moments that you remember seeing, are those moments that were equally or more funny to a savvy versus a tourist type audience? What is it about those moments that made them funny?
That's a great question. And on one level, who knows? I think there were probably moments that anybody would find funny. But part of the communication that you're talking about as far as what's funny and what's not is guided by the reaction of the audience. Sometimes you'll say something and not realize that it's funny at all, but the audience laughs. And then you can sort of try to deconstruct, okay, why are they laughing right now? Oh, I see what they're finding funny. And then that can be sort of the focus of the scene. And that the audience can help you find what's funny about it. So I think when it's really working, it's not just the improvisers finding it funny, but it's in sort of collaboration with the audience. Maybe the improviser clarifies something they're already finding mm-hmm. funny, and then the audience laughs at that and kind of gives the go-ahead to like, yeah, you should pursue that and kind of push for that. I've definitely done shows where I think something is hilariously funny and keep doing it, and the audience doesn't like it, and I keep doing it anyway because it just feels very satisfying to me. But I think in an ideal situation, everybody's enjoying it as much as I am.
There is something that improv at its base is play. It's not too much more complicated than that. And I think play is its most fun when everybody is enjoying the same thing at the same time. So if you have those audiences of improvisers, they're watching little pieces of it that another portion of the audience is not going to get. And now we're not all together.
But even on the best show you can imagine, one of the things that constantly amazes me is that the whole audience can be laughing at something, but they're probably laughing for at least six or seven different reasons.
That's true.
They're finding different things funny. They're all, to them, it feels like they're all laughing at the same thing, probably. And from the stage, it might feel like, oh, they're all laughing at the same thing. But you're thinking they're laughing at the way you're understanding the funny thing. And they might have a bunch of different understandings of what's funny about it. Part of it is they hear everybody else laughing, so they laugh as well. So they're predisposed to laugh. But it can honestly be very different understandings of what's funny moment by moment. So there is that feeling of unity there where everybody's laughing at something, but it is interesting to me as an improviser and a teacher. They can be laughing for different reasons. And that's I think, a good thing for students to know, too, because sometimes it can be it can feel really alienating for everyone else to think something is funny, and then it just doesn't seem funny to you, or to explain or why you think something's funny. Yeah, you see it differently. It's just maybe you have different life experience, or you just heard it differently or understood it differently. And then some things are funny to some people and not funny to others. When you're the only one who feels that way, or one of only a few people, it can feel a little alienating. I know when I go to a new comedy theater and they have sort of things that they find funny at that theater, there's often a little disconnect when maybe it's the first show I've seen of a particular group from another town, or going to another theater in another city. Sometimes there's that feeling of sitting in an audience and wondering why everybody's laughing. That can feel strange. But now I know that it's just, they probably have a shared understanding of maybe the performer's performing, maybe the tendencies of that performer. So it's especially funny to see that performer do a particular thing. But there's so many reasons to laugh. And when we don't always share the same reasons. But part of the game of the scene is, how close to understanding the funny thing the same way can we get?
At least as performers, and then the audiences can latch onto it as they choose to.
Absolutely. And sometimes you leave the audience in the dust and it's just a really fun show for the group. I'm on Herald Night at UCB, one of the Herald teams. And there are definitely shows where we have a successful show where we really enjoy it and the audience really enjoys it. And there's definitely shows where the audience maybe still enjoyed it, but it felt a little, the laughs felt a little light. But we get backstage and what we say to each other is, well, I mean, we had a lot of fun. So hopefully the audience did too, even if they weren't showing it. But that can be even more fun. It's almost like a bonding experience if you, as improvisers, have an amazing time and for some reason the audience wasn't enjoying it as much as you feel they should have.
So when you have those moments, do you also look back and say, well, what was this room like? What was different about this room that maybe we could have connected with them a little bit more deeply?
Honestly, we mostly use it as a crutch. Oh, they should have laughed more, as opposed to dissecting what each individual audience might be like. It could be the same audience just on a different night, and they're just feeling the comedy differently. I think there's, when you're performing for an audience of a couple hundred people or more, who knows what's going on? Maybe the air conditioning isn't working that good, or maybe there's a big party of people who were there and they thought they were going to see a different show, or maybe you just weren't that great that night. One of the sort of guides that I use is, how are my teammates responding? Because I worked with them so much that's sort of a control group, I guess, where I know how they typically respond to me. So it's different than usual. I can pretty much understand there might have been something different about the way I was doing it.
Well, there's a lot of things that I've still got in mind to talk to you about, Morgan, but I did want to get into a couple of things, including something that you've got coming up for your 25th. But before we get to that, talk about what you did for your 20th anniversary in improv, and that was the 1,000 scenes in a year.
Yeah, I knew with my 20 years of improv anniversary that I wanted to celebrate it in some way. So the anniversary was the fall of 2014, I guess. And then I spent all of 2015 doing this project I came up with, the 1,000 Scenes project. And the idea was, the original idea was, oh, I've met so many improvisers over the years. I know way more than 1,000 improvisers. What if I try to do Google Hangout online improv scenes, remote improv scenes with 1,000 different people that I know? And that was the original idea for the project. And I quickly realized that not everybody I knew who was an improviser wanted to do an online scene on Google Hangouts or had time to do one. And so quickly it became not just the people I knew, but a lot of people I didn't know. And people were kind enough to spread the word in the improv community. And so I ended up doing scenes with, it was about half or more people that I had never met. Maybe as much, maybe 600 of the 1,000 were people I'd never met before, much less done improv with. And they were from literally all over the world. No one from Antarctica, but I think every other continent. Many, many different countries, all in English. Thankfully, I wasn't forced to improvise in another language only because I would have done a terrible job. Although I did, I guess technically it was another language. One of the improvisers was a dog. Somebody had their dog in an improv scene with me.
Did they get game?
They were a good listener.
Okay.
Good eye contact.
Great on contact. Occasionally it would waver. There was something interesting just off camera. But so over the course of 2015, the goal was to do 1,000 improv scenes, and I ended up doing slightly more than 1,000 improv scenes with over 1,000 different improvisers. And it was an amazing experience and also a horrible experience.
What was great about it?
What was great? Well, from a selfish standpoint, I feel like I got a lot better at doing organic scenes, is how I would refer to them, where it's just a one word is inspiration, and then we improvise a scene together, as opposed to a premise-based scene where we would do an opening and then draw things from the opening. So that specific skill of just doing basically that thing that I loved from short form back in the day, the game that we called Scene from One Word. I did that with 1,000 different people, more than 1,000 different people and one dog over the course of a year. So selfishly, it made me better at that, or at least much more confident about doing that after doing it with so many different types of improvisers of all different experience levels, including a few people who had never done improv before that scene. And also I met some people. I don't think that I continued conversations with anyone that I didn't then at some point meet in the real world. But I've met a lot of people since then that was the first time I was quote unquote meeting them over the internet. And then maybe they came to the Del Close Marathon when it was still in New York, or they moved to New York, or they're just visiting. We realized, we've done improv together before. And so that was a nice beginning of our improv relationship. So that was great as well, meeting all those people and forming some bonds that way.
And so what was terrible about it?
So it was a technological project, and it was connecting to different people's computers. And so virtually every single one had its own technical problems to solve. So doing that literally over 1,000 times got to be a little draining. Also, because I had this lofty goal of over 1,000 people, which meant averaging almost 3 people a day, literally every single day, throughout the year, I was constantly begging people to do scenes with, by begging, I just mean like posting something on Facebook
right.
or emailing someone. It was, as begging goes, it was pretty light begging, but asking for something over and over and over again for an entire year felt very draining for me, especially as someone who feels sort of shy about asking people to collaborate with him. I hadn't realized when I got into it that would be a part of it, of like constantly asking for something over and over and over again for almost an entire year.
Did that make you more comfortable asking people for connections or favors or
time?
I don't think it did. I think maybe the baseline went up a little bit. Maybe I'm slightly more comfortable, but I settled into a zone of still not particularly enjoying it, but still having to do it over and over again, because I had said publicly that I would do 1,000 scenes, and especially after I'd done 500 or 600, it would have felt like such a waste to not actually make it to 1,000. So I felt bound by what I'd already done. I was pot committed, to use a poker term.
Yeah, the personal commitment and growth probably is around 2,500 scenes.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I'll try. People did joke, hey, what are you going to do next time? You do 10,000 scenes? And I would laugh and get a very faraway look in my eyes and feel some pain at the very idea of doing even 1,000 scenes again. I don't think I would ever do that.
Yeah.
At least not in a year, maybe over the course of a lifetime.
But you do have something that you're planning to do starting this fall. How much are you talking about what that is?
Well, still a little hush-hush. As we speak, it hasn't been fully revealed what the project is. And part of it is that I'm hoping it will evolve along the way. So rather than setting out a specific goal for this one, like I did the last time, and then have to live up to that goal, I'm setting a very general description and then going to let it evolve into whatever it wants to be. But in basic terms, the name of the project is the Not a Bit Comedy Theater. And I can tell you that it is a digital collaboration involving improv, but also comedy on video in general. And there's a collaborative aspect to it, but I've designed it so that it will also work if nobody wants to collaborate with me. It can be just something that I do on my own, and I will, encourage other people to participate, but there won't be the component of begging this time.
Okay.
So unfortunately, if all it would take was another few times of asking people to do things to cure myself of a fear of that, this project will not get me over the hump.
So that's something that you're going to announce on your site. You have a Twitter handle already?
Yeah, the Twitter name for the project is at Not a Bit Comedy, NotaBit Comedy. And so that would be a good source of finding out what's going on, or at least what's going on at the time that people check out what's going on, because as I say, I'm sure it will evolve into something else.
And is this something that you're planning to reveal in this fall?
Yeah, on August 8th, which as we speak has not happened yet, but I guess may have already happened by the time people hear this. So 8-8, the project will be at least fully revealed to at least the extent that I know what it is.
All right. And if you've put yourself out another 25 years, do you see yourself still doing improv at that point?
Wow. Yes. In what capacity? I have no idea. I guess part of me hopes I've become one of those people who has become so wildly successful in a more lucrative area that I make as much time for improv as I can, but don't get to do quite as much as I would like to. It's weird to think about something that's my passion. Like, I'm looking forward to the day where I'm not able to do as much of it as I'd like to, but probably more likely I'll be doing much of the same thing, hopefully still teaching and performing. Mm-hmm. It's something that I've found continually enjoyable and has stayed fresh for literally 25 years now. As opposed to everything else I've ever been passionate about, where it's either been for a smaller amount of time or I've done it intensely for a while and kind of moved on to something else. I think because of the nature of improv, it's constantly changing. And doing with new people changes it as well. And becoming a different person changes it as well. So it's the course of multiple decades. I'm definitely not the same person I was when I started doing improv. So it's almost like a brand new thing,
right?
Each time you do it. I guess that's what improv is.
My last question for this interview, because we are coming up on time. Do you think that improv itself is different today than it was 10 years ago?
I do. There's been more penetration into general pop culture. I think it's much more likely if you tell somebody, I'm an improviser, that they actually have a chance of knowing what you're talking about now.
Yeah.
Still very much, they still might totally think you're talking about something else, but it's much more likely. And I think part of that is that many more people do improv. And because many more people do improv, that's also changed improv. I think it's been, the diversity in improv has changed, has gotten a lot better. One of the things I love about improv is people bringing their unique perspectives to it. And the more unique perspectives you get, the more interesting the improv is. So I would say that I can definitely say the improv is more interesting now, potentially, mm-hmm. because there's just more voices in it. And other than that, I guess it's just bigger now. It's being done in more places by more people.
Morgan, I've really enjoyed this time. I'm glad that we were able to spend a little time talking about your story and perspective on improv. So we'll make sure that people can connect with you and catch where you're teaching or performing. Really, again, Morgan, thanks for being with us on the Improv Comedy Connection.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Well, I hope you got as much out of that conversation as I did. Some things that stood out to me were the importance of communicating well with those that you work with, and also understanding that the audience or your co-performers may have different ideas about what was funny in a particular moment. Although it might not affect that first laugh, if you return to a theme in a show or a sketch, and the audience or your co-performers didn't have that same sense of what was funny, you might get off track when some better communication up front might really help. And if you value a personal connection in your craft, be open to working on your stuff, your personal stuff. I agree with Morgan that improv or stand-up or speaking isn't therapy, but it can be something that highlights what's keeping you from becoming a better you. You can catch Morgan at the UCB and find him on the web at morganphillips.com, and there's two L's in Phillips. He's on social media at Morgan on Twitter, and check out his Not a Bit Comedy Theater at Not a Bit Comedy on Twitter, which was mentioned in the podcast, and it's now live, so you can check that out right now. There will be more info and links for all things Morgan Phillips on the show page at improvcomedyconnection.com. If this has been useful to you, please spread the word, rate, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you think this could be more useful or you have a great idea for a topic or a guest for a future episode, please let me know. I'm doing this to be of help to you as we work together to connect more deeply with each other and our audiences through comedy. It's been my pleasure to be your host on this episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. My name again is Whit Schiller, and I'm an improviser out of Milwaukee with Fish Sticks Comedy. You can check out the work we do at fishstickscomedy.com, and you can connect with me on social media at Whit Schiller on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Yet to stumble upon, but if I do, I'll try to use that same handle. Thanks again for tuning in to the Improv Comedy Connection.